This is Car Expert.
We actually bought more Chinese cars than we did German cars last month, which I thought was really quite interesting.
Wow.
At this stage, I just can't see how the Navara is going to work in its current state.
There was one guy who took all three models on the Autobahn, and the TCR actually out-accelerated the R from 100 to 200.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner, and this week I'm joined by two of the three Car Expert founders, Al Borsfeller. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Very good. And Paul Marrick, hello.
G'day, Mandy. How are you?
Very excited, actually. Big news for Car Expert this week. I saw something on social media this week, Paul, something about like taking it to the next level. Fill us in.
Yes. We are getting into the clothing business. We've, we've taken over a city beach store at Warringah Mall on the Northern Beaches because we're launching something. We can't give away too many details just yet, but it's going to change the way that you buy cars, and more not so much change the way that you buy cars, but change the way that you research new cars. You already have the Car Expert website, which is ad-free and easy to use and fast and all that kind of thing, but we're going to take it one step further. Elbows, do you want to fill in some of the blanks, the cryptic blanks?
Yeah, that was probably the worst introduction to what we're doing.
I just realized that.
But that's okay. That's why we keep Paul on YouTube and we leave the serious stuff to the rest of us. But it's called the Car Expert Experience Center. I think we can talk a fair bit about it because most of it's quite public now. But the simple idea is that instead of, say you're looking for a medium-sized SUV, and instead of spending a lot of time going from one dealer to another, if you're in the market for, say, three or four different ones and not sure which one to check, you can come to one place, you can see them all, you can sit in them, you can put your baby seat in them, and best of all, you can actually test drive them all from the one location. We have all the cars in valet for test drive. And I guess the most important aspect of all of this is that there's not a single salesperson in the center. There's no sale. There's, you know, all the knowledge, all the expert without the sale. So, and I know everyone listening is going, well, how do you make money? But we'll talk about that at a later point. But the idea is really simple, is that, you know, come to one place, have all the cars there, drive as many as you want, make your mind up, and then go to a dealer that's suited to you and buy the car. That way we just make the whole experience a lot easier.
You know what? That actually sounds like a really good description, Elbows. Much better than what I thinking back, I'm like, okay, that was terrible.
How many cars do you have on offer?
We will have around 20. So most of them, great majority of them actually in the store itself, and then a couple outside around the center. And then all of them will also be available for test drive from the valet. So you can come in, you can book, you can chat to us, you can book online. You could do anything basically. We're just there to help people make the right decision.
And you know what? Any of you that have been to our open days, we had a lot of those at the old place. A lot of you loved coming in, being able to see new cars, seeing what's new on the market, also being able to talk to us, and you're in a pressure-free environment. We're not trying to sell you anything, and that doesn't change. Now, we don't care what you end up buying. We just want you to make the best decision possible. Your research journey starts on the Car Expert website, and it's going to end with us in the store where you'll be able to experience these cars, test drive them, and talk to us. And the best thing is that this won't just be limited to Sydney. So this will be national before long. So we're really looking forward to seeing everyone there. And I don't know, we need some of you to help us staff this thing as well. So I think, Elbows, we're going to be reaching out to some people to see if they can assist us as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure there are hundreds of people out there that know more about four-wheel drives than I do. So
thousands, millions actually.
Millions. That's right. So I'll be manning the supercar stand in the corner, but unfortunately we don't have any there. So
whose idea was this? How did it all start?
that's
a big question, I know.
That's a question that we all would say it's my idea. Paul would say it was his idea. Our CEO, Andrew, would say it was his idea. People that probably don't work for the company will say it was their idea. But ultimately,
actual fact, it was Will's idea.
Yeah, that's right. The fact of the matter is, Mandy, and I always say this to a lot of people starting out in business, that the idea is 5%, right? Like, actually the execution, making it happen, and actually doing it, that's the other 95%. So the idea, when you explain it to someone, everyone's like, oh, that's such a good idea. Not one person has said, that's a terrible idea, I would never use that. Everyone's like, of course I would use that. Why the hell would I not use that if I was looking to buy a car that you have in there?
And you're right, Elvis, because this would be like us 10 years ago saying, hey, I've got an idea for an app where someone can come and pick you up and you never have to be in a taxi again, where you can never recover anything you've lost and the cars are generally roadworthy. You'd go, oh, well, I had that idea first. And it's like, yeah, but to implement that, that is the hard part. So anyone can have an idea, but actually, like Elbow said, making it happen, that's the tricky part.
Yeah, and it is a tricky part. And there's a lot of stuff for us to do. As you may have seen, Mandy, I think you mentioned it, we went to the store. There's a lot to do to that store to get it ready. It's opening sometime in April. We've got a lot to do there. Hey, I mean, you saw Paul sweeping the floors. I can assure you he was doing that predominantly for the camera. He's never done that in his life. Look, once it's all fitted out and looking a lot better, we'll have a lot more to talk about. But, yeah, it's a fundamentally big shift for the business, although we had planned for it from day one. So it's not like it's something new to us. This was the original idea. This was always the idea, and we're really excited to get it going. And as Paul said, it'll be the first of hopefully many, many to come. So we'll likely do two in Sydney this year and hopefully next year in Melbourne and then Brisbane to follow, and then and sort of we go from there.
What's the reaction been like from the OEMs? I'm assuming they're pretty excited about it.
Most are, yeah, absolutely. I think the majority of the cars that are in there have the OEM support. They certainly are excited about – you know what? They all realize that the way people shop for cars is changing. That old traditional method of buying cars, of, you know, going in on a Saturday and then, you know, spending the next 3 weeks being sort of cold and not knowing this and not knowing that, it's all changing. You know, people do all their research online. People would actually almost prefer to do the whole thing online, but there's an element of wanting to see the car you buy in person before actually paying, you know, 30, 40, 50, 100 grand for it. And we sort of try and provide that in an environment where there is no sale, there's less anxiety, you know, so you feel a lot more welcome coming in, because it's like, you know, when you walk into an Apple store and someone will stand there and talk to you for 45 minutes, even if you don't buy anything, that's what we're going for, because, you know, we want you to feel like you can come in and you can ask all your questions. And if we can help you and we can steer you in the right direction, of the car that is actually right for you, because there is a bum for every seat, right? All these cars, that it's suited to somebody, and our job is just to find the right person for the right car.
Beautifully said. Really exciting news, guys, and looking forward to seeing this grow much bigger in the future. All right, we'll get stuck into this week's news. The 2022 Volvo C40 Recharge is coming to Australia, Paul.
Yeah, what an interesting car. I had no idea personally they were working on this. The C40, was it the C30, that little hatchback thing they had ages ago? I think it was. Let me quickly Google
it. It looks like. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Volvo C30. Yeah, it was that little hatchback thing. So the C40 kind of has hallmarks of that, where it's a coupe-style crossover, and it's going to be in Australia by the end of 2022. It's full electric, and it kind of melds with Volvo's plan to go full electric by 2030. And this is one of the products. It basically shares a platform with the it shares the all-electric drivetrain with the XC40 P8 Recharge and the Polestar 2. And it's got two identical motors for each axle that generate 300 kilowatts of power and 660 newton meters of torque together, which is a fair chunk of go there. It'll do 0 to 100 in just under 5 seconds, and it has a battery that is 78 kilowatt hours in size, range of around 420 kilometers. So it looks pretty cool. I quite like the look of it. What do you guys reckon?
Is this part of the whole concept of them going all online and selling all electric by 2030? And is this just trying to sort of warm us into it slowly? Because I don't know. I know you're in a Tesla, Paul, but does that car really appeal to you? And I feel like it's a bit slow at just under 5 seconds.
Yeah, look, I don't know. To me, I think Tesla has ruined electric cars in terms of acceleration, because if you
Not for themselves.
No, not for themselves, but if you deleted Tesla's acceleration figures, all of these cars would actually be pretty good, because a full electric car under 5 seconds, I'd be happy with that. But for me, I like you, like going fast. I want to make sure I'm the first off the lights, just in case. And for me, I have absolutely no need for that much power or torque, but I just love having it there because it's fun. So, yeah, I think I agree with you, Oldballs, that yes, this is really great. But, I would just love to see something super, super fast. And, yeah, this will be sold online. And it goes down the path of what a lot of manufacturers are doing now, where they're selling online at fixed prices. And I don't know, just slightly digressing. For me, I love that model because when I bought the Tesla, I knew that no one else got it for cheaper. We all paid the same price. I'm terrible at haggling. Whereas when you buy a traditional car, you go to a dealer. If someone knows the dealer principal or they're mates with someone there and they can get a better price, you end up feeling a little cheated.
Yeah. That's my opinion. I agree on that part. I think certainly the model changing to online is definitely the way to go. But going back to the car itself, what's the pricing? Like, do we have any idea? Like, is there any indication?
No, not yet. But you look at the figures there. So 78 kilowatt hour, that's a big battery pack.
That's a big battery.
Yeah, decent range. I think, without knowing anything here, I think that's going to be a $60,000, $70,000 car.
Oh, I think 60 would be pretty cheap. I suspect it might be a bit more, but I don't know. Like, I'm looking at it right now, looking at the photos, and it's hard to get it excited. I got to be honest. Like, I don't know why electric cars need to look so boring. And I don't know. Like you said, Tesla has ruined it. I want to see acceleration figures sub 3. Otherwise, I'm just not excited by it. Because if that Model S Plaid can do 2.1, like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's kind of like you look at this and you go, what's wrong with it? Like, why is it so slow?
Oh, Jesus.
We're going to talk to James Wong a little bit later on for a Volkswagen Golf GTI comparison. But Alborz, another GTI edition has been unveiled.
Yeah, that's right. The Golf GTI Club Sport 45, which is celebrating 45 years of since the original Golf GTI launched. It's not yet confirmed for Australia. I don't know if we'll get it or not, but hopefully we do. It looks pretty cool. It's based on the Club Sport that came out last year. It's certainly made for Europe, although I'm quite surprised to read that it's got an Akrapovic exhaust, because I was under the impression that you couldn't sell a brand new car with a loud exhaust. It wouldn't meet any of the sort of new regulations over in Europe. So I'm keen to know how that works. It must be bimodal or something. But either way, you know, it's got 45 badging. It looks quite cool. I love the wheels. It hasn't got a top speed restriction like the normal GDI, and the power.
It's definitely not coming to Australia then.
yeah. The power is based on the Club Sport. Like I said before, so it's 221 kilowatts and 400 newton meters. That hasn't changed, and that's quite up on the 181 and 370 you get on the standard GDI. So 6 seconds to 100. It's pretty decent. I like the look of it. It'd be nice to actually just drive a normal GTI at some point, and I suspect they arrive around May. So I love that interior of the Golf 8. I really do. And I love the steering wheel in the GTI. Mm. So I'm really looking forward to getting behind the wheel of one of these. It's amazing that they can keep making the Golf better, because I get into the TCR, GTI TCR, and I kind of go, this is pretty good. Like, it's where they're going to go from here. So I'm keen to see where they have.
Paul, the 2021 Havel H6. We know when that's coming to Australia.
Yes, it'll be here second quarter of 2021. I never thought I'd say this about a Havel product, but I think this actually looks really good.
It does. Yeah.
And I like what they've done on the interior as well. It's kind of I shouldn't say this given they do this a lot, but it's kind of like a clone of the new Tucson with the screen ahead of the driver instead of analog gauges, and then a screen in the center of the cabin. It's quite an impressive setup. Now, the other good thing about this is it sits on a new platform and it's lighter now significantly. So the old H6 weighed 15 kilos, the new one's 15.55. It's also longer and wider than the new Tucson, which sits on a longer wheelbase. So this is actually going to be a really impressive sized car. So I'll be keen to see it in person. The reason it's lighter, and I have to have a laugh here, it's because it uses the new Great Wall Motors Lemon platform, which stands for Lightweight Electrification, Multi-Purpose, Omni-Protection and Network.
They really need to change that name.
Yeah, if only they knew what that meant.
Lemon platform. I love that. That's fantastic.
Lost in translation, I think. It does look impressive to me. So I'm really keen to have a drive of this. The engine doesn't sound amazing. It's a 2-litre turbocharged 4-cylinder petrol, 150 kilowatts, 320 newton metres. If it's anything like the last one that I drove, it was just slow and revvy and not efficient. So let's hope that perhaps there's a little bit of tuning done to that before it lands here. But on the face of it actually looks pretty cool.
Have you driven a Havel Albols?
I have driven no Havel. No, actually, have I driven a Havel? I can't remember.
Why are you asking us?
I don't know.
No, I don't.
He's asking Will now.
No, I am. I'm turning to ask Will because we were having this conversation here because I'm driving a Land Cruiser LC200 at the moment. And Will goes, how does it compare to the Nissan Patrol? I'm like, I don't know. He goes, well, you reviewed one. And I was like, oh, yeah, I have. So I had to go and look up my own review.
utterly hopeless.
I don't know. I review a car. I publish it. Then I erase it from my memory, unfortunately. So it's like Homer Simpson, you know. Okay. If I remember that time that you made me learn something and I forgot how to drive and Marge goes, Homer, you were drunk. That's pretty much me, except that I don't drink.
Oh, jeez.
And we bring in an extra member of the panel to complete this week's news. Hello, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy. Hello, team.
We'll keep you on a bit later to talk VFacts and the Nissan Navara. But first news, in a nation where we are now used to seeing 5 ANCAP safety stars on new cars, it was a bit of a shock to see the Mitsubishi Express was slapped with a 0-star rating this week. Have we ever seen anything like this in Australia before?
No. No, we have. There's never been a 0-star crash test. There has been a few 1-star crash tests, one of which, funnily enough, was the previous Mitsubishi Express van, and there was also the Proton Jump Buck way back in the day. But no, never a 0-star result. And so, understandably, the news this week was greeted with, well, quite a lot of headlines and quite a lot of attention.
So how did the Express actually get the 0 stars in the first place?
Well, it comes down fundamentally to active safety. So basically the story behind the Express, for those who aren't aware, is that it's a badge-engineered Renault Trafic. In other words, it is literally a Renault Trafic with a Mitsubishi badge slapped on the front, made in the same plant. Everything about it is the same. That car is quite an old design now. It's about six or seven years old in design. And so it was developed for earlier, easier safety tests. It's got none of the active safety features like AEB, blind spot monitoring, or lane assist. And the Renault version got 3 stars using Euro NCAP testing way back in 2015. Now, ANCAP, they argue that because this Express was launched as a new car, it should be tested against the 2021 testing protocols, which are far harder than what the vehicle was actually designed for way back in the day. And because it only scored 7% in the active safety section, because it doesn't have anything, the way that they work it is, it cannot get more than 0 stars. Even though it got 55% for occupant protection and 40% for vulnerable road user protection. Now, those two scores are not exactly great. It's certainly not as safe as a 5-star Toyota Hiace or a 5-star Ford Transit Custom. But I think you could probably argue the point that a vehicle that gets given 0 stars, you would imagine would be a death trap that explodes like the Hindenburg the moment it collides with an obstacle. If you actually do a side-by-side comparison of this new Express with the old 1-star Express, the old 1-star Express had no airbags and the crumple zones were so bad that essentially the driver was literally squashed amongst the mangled metal, whereas in the new one, you know, they're a lot more protected than they were. So I think there's probably some ambiguity and a lack of clarity in ANCAP's testing where it is saying that it's going to scale up the difficulty of its tests every single year, which makes a heap of sense. But then vehicles like this that are older in design, that get tested against new metrics, fail miserably. And it opens up the other story about, well, how many other vehicles floating around now would be 0-star cars if they were tested against 2021 protocols? You know, vans like the Hyundai Ilo, the number 2 selling van in the country that has no AEB, no lane assist or anything like that, which has a 4-star 2011 rating, there's a very good chance that it would probably get a similar score to the Express if tested again today. So it's complicated even more by the fact that a lot of fleets will not buy vehicles that aren't 5-star. So this basically kills the Mitsubishi Express for the majority of buyers. Mitsubishi's not going to get rid of it, but it certainly, you know, hindered that program massively. So I don't know. It's a tough one. I mean, ultimately, the safety score's appalling and the performance is subpar. I would argue not necessarily what you'd expect a 0-star car to be, but certainly plenty of work to be done. The good news is AEB and lane assist will be fitted to that vehicle at some point, but we don't exactly know when, and it could still be a year or more away. So for the time being, that result will stand.
Mm-hmm. What has the response been from the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, Marco?
Confused would be one way to put it. A confused message was the actual quote that the FCAI used. Then again, keep in mind that the FCAI is the peak body for car brands, not for ANCAP. So there's obviously a vested interest there. But the quote goes, Why is ANCAP spending potentially up to $500,000, which includes taxpayer dollars, to undertake tests on a six-year-old vehicle that has already been assessed by its sister organisation, Euro NCAP, in 2015? It makes no sense and sends a confused message to Australian car buyers. That's what Tony Webber, the boss of the FCAI, said. Now, the reason, in short, is that the Renault traffic got 3 stars against Euro testing, which wasn't in line with Aussie testing back in 2015. But again, this opens up that whole ambiguity angle, which is while ANCAP technically is correct that it's a new vehicle and technically is correct that it hasn't put that vehicle up against its latest testing until now, it's a bit confusing. You know, you hear that the old Express is 1 star and the new one's 0, and you think that the new one's less safe. But if you look at pictures of the new one and the old one crashing side by side, I know which one I'd rather be sitting in, and it ain't the 1 star one. So, you know, ANCAP has, and we love ANCAP at Car Expert. We use them regularly for the safety sections of our reviews, and we lean on them heavily. But I think there is an argument that there's a bit of ambiguity and a lack of clarity, perhaps, just to get punters to fully understand what the testing is. I don't quite know the answer. Maybe separating active safety and passive safety into two, in which case this would probably be a 2 or 3 star car, could be an answer. I'm not sure, but it's definitely been a bit of an interesting one to watch this week.
Don't you? I don't know. I'm not as confused by the result because, to me, it's a car that's been released this year, or last year, sorry, and they're crash testing it. So the fact that it relates in some way to the traffic, you get if you're someone who understands that stuff. But to the average punter, they probably don't care how it relates to a Renault or what the Renault scored. So I think that Mitsubishi shouldn't be surprised because they know exactly how the testing procedures work. And if anyone is surprised, they probably need to find another job because this is all public information. It's not like they've gone and changed the rules and only targeted Mitsubishi. So I would personally not be buying that car given that safety rating. And if Mitsubishi has the option now of fitting more safety features to that vehicle, they really should be doing that in line with keeping their customers safe.
Yeah, and look, I wouldn't buy it either. I think that score's woeful. I think the only argument you could make to counter that, Paulie, is that a Renault Trafic, which is an identical car, has a 3-star Euro NCAP rating. It's the same vehicle. One's 3, 1's 0. So one sounds like it's kind of safe and one sounds like it's a death trap, but in reality, they're the same car. That's where it gets a bit confusing for the average punter.
Yeah, I think the problem isn't that it got a 0 safety rating. It's exactly what you said, Moko, is that the 0 safety rating isn't the same as a 3-star rating a couple of years ago. And it does confuse people. Hey, like that's a bizarre. ANCAP's safety doesn't really make sense because companies still use their ratings from 6-7 years ago.
No, I think they're capped because Volkswagen.
Is it 5 years?
Yeah, Volkswagen stopped using their 5-star safety rating for the Amarok. Six I think years. It's 7 years from memory.
7 years. 7 years.
And I can if count. You look at stuff like the Amarok, which was last tested in 2011 and has or had a 5-star safety rating, that's a car that doesn't have airbags. I agree that it's very confusing and perhaps the limit needs to be 5 years or perhaps you shouldn't be able to advertise it if it's more than a year since the crash test happened. I don't know, but I understand there is confusion. I just don't think that the confusion should be with anybody in the car industry because it's quite clear what the standards are for crash tests.
I certainly wouldn't be defending Mitsubishi here. I mean, the fact of the matter is whether it's 3 stars, 2 stars, 0 stars, there's no way in hell it's even close to a 5-star car. And when you consider that the new Hiace, Transit Custom, Mercedes Vito are all 5-star cars.
What's the price difference, Marco?
Oh, the Express isn't that cheap, to be honest with you. It's not some Chinese LDV that costs half what its competitors do. You know what? If I'm an OH&S guy at a company buying a fleet of vans, there's no way in hell I'm buying a car that isn't 5 when there are 5-star options. And there just is. It isn't good enough to launch a car today that isn't 5 stars. Whether you could argue that this should be 0 or should be maybe 2 or 3 is probably where the argument really sits. But at the end of the day, it was a bad result.
Fair enough. You can read more about that story at the site. But for now, we will move on to the new car sales figures for February. How did we fare last month, Moko?
Yeah, it wasn't a bad month. Sales grew just over 5% to a tick under 84,000 new cars, SUVs and commercials. Wasn't quite the growth we saw in January, but it was still up on February of 2020. Of course, February of 2020 was when we weren't quite sure what this whole COVID thing was all about. Little did we know that our lives would be turned upside down, particularly down here in Victoria. But look, nevertheless, it's good to see the market on an uptick. It was actually the private market doing the heavy lifting. So private sales grew 16% for the month to 43,500, while business fleet sales actually went backwards. So it's the nation's mums and dads that are really driving this. Really interesting to me was the fact that SUVs actually had well above 50% market share again. So that's really sort of where all the growth is at. Pickup trucks also grew at a rate of knots. Again, mostly in the private market was what was driving the growth of those pickup trucks or utes. And probably the real headline for most people, though, was the fact that MG, the rapidly growing Chinese brand, finished inside the top 10 for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Which is a staggering result. It finished ninth. It actually beat Volkswagen, it beat Subaru, and it beat Honda. So you told somebody that anyone not, they would have laughed at you.
Is anyone not beating Honda? I just wanted to know.
Well, Honda Honda is not doing well, and they've obviously got a whole new strategy in place around agency models and things. But yes, Honda is on the downward slope. That is very true in terms of volume. But look, it was a pretty run-of-the-mill month in terms of what happened. The top-selling models, as you'd usually expect, were the Hilux, the Ranger, the RAV4, and the Corolla in the top four positions. But you've got to come back to that Chinese wave that we've been speaking about. You know, MG finishing inside the top 10 is a fairly staggering result, I would say. But then you also had GWM/Haval, which is now considered a joint company. That grew 210% for the month as well. LDV grew 65%.
A quick question, Micah, just on GWM. Have they actually changed the name of the company from Great Wall Motors? Was it Great Wall Motors previously or?
Super confusing, man. So Great Wall is the parent company and then GWM is the ute brand and Haval is the SUV brand. A bit like how Volkswagen Group is the main company, but then Volkswagen is a separate brand.
Does GWM actually stand for something?
Great Wall Motors.
I did notice on their ads it's now Great Motoring. What is it? Great. I don't know. They've got something else to take away from the fact that it's a Chinese company, which I just found interesting.
Well, no matter what the case, they're selling a lot more cars now than they were this time last
year. It's a pretty damn good car, though. We had one of those utes up here in Brizzy, and I tell you what, everywhere I took it, people asked me what it was and then checked inside. And there's a guy in a Hilux that came and sat in, and he's like, "This is such a better interior than my car." And I was like, "Yes, it is." He was really shocked when I told him how much it was. I must have lied and said it was 25 grand, but it was still
But Albert, when was the last time you drove any other ute?
I drove a Raptor in Melbourne when I picked it up. And that was the interior of that car was shocking compared to the GWM.
Anyway, back to the subject at hand. So Toyota number one, up 4%, 21% market share. Mazda in second grew 15%. Hyundai third grew 5%. Mitsubishi had a great month, up double digits in fourth. Kia in fifth, edging out Ford in sixth. Nissan in seventh. Mercedes-Benz in eighth if you combine the vans and the cars like I do, like the FCAI doesn't. Really weird one, that. MG in ninth, ahead of Volkswagen in 10th, which was down 17%. Subaru, Isuzu, Honda, BMW and Suzuki rounding out the top 15. As I said before, the top models, really not a whole lot of surprises there. A couple of interesting little factoids, fact and figures, though. So the top sources of new vehicles, China was number four ahead of Germany. So we actually bought more Chinese cars than we did German cars last month, which I thought was really quite interesting.
Wow.
Electric vehicles, still very low, still like 0.4% of the market, but growing really, you know, quite slowly, but growing nevertheless. Hybrid cars still doing really, really well. The first 20 hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles were actually registered. They're all Hyundai Nexo SUVs. And I've got a quote here from the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, basically saying during the past 4 months, we've seen an increase in new vehicles of nearly 11%, reflecting in strong growth in New South Wales, Queensland, WA, South Australia, and the Northern Territory. Sales reduction in Victoria, he said, can be contributed to the COVID-19 restrictions that were put in place during the month. But most of the car brands and the FCA are highly confident that this trend of growth will continue in an environment where business operating conditions continue to normalize. So the real takeaway is that the car industry is rebounding. There are stock shortfalls that we're widely aware of, brands struggling to get cars on the ground because factories overseas have all been shuttered for, you know, very long periods of time now. But the demand is super high, especially from private buyers. And once that business fleet market starts to rebound again, when business surety returns, and once stock on the ground is where it needs to be, I think you'll find that sales growth will skyrocket.
Well, the full VFACTS wrap can be found up at carexpert.com. We might just slowly move from that, but I might ask you, how did the Nissan Navara go this last month?
The Nissan Navara, how did it go last month? It's lucky, you're lucky I've got my spreadsheet in front of me here, Mandy, because, you know, question without notice and all that jazz. I'm scrolling through as we speak. Nissan Navara, it did 756 4x4s, down 2.5%, and 4x2s were down a lot. But that's probably due to supply restrictions because, as I'm sure you're about to refer to, a updated model just arrived.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have driven it, the 2021 Nissan Navara. Which variant did you drive, or did you drive the whole range?
So I only drove the STX, which is the second from top variant, below a new model that's newly introduced called the Pro 4X, which has a bunch of tough-looking 4x4-oriented accoutrements on it, big mud-plugging tyres and bars and all that sort of stuff. It's actually a streamlined range now, so there's only four variants. The old DX and RX fleet models have been axed. Nissan seems to have given up playing at that really cheap end of the market, and that means that the actual price of entry now is a bit higher than it used to be. So you've got the SL, you've got the ST, you've got the STX, and the Pro 4X. And this really is the kind of update that the car needed. I think the Navara tends to get a little bit forgotten. You know, everyone talks about the Ranger and Hilux being the top sellers. They talk about the new D-Max and BT50 as the exciting new kids on the block. The Amarok is the big, powerful V6. The Triton's for bargain hunters. The new Chinese brands people are curious about. And the poor old Navara, it sort of gets a bit forgotten, a bit lost. But I think this update really does kind of bring it up to where it needs to be. There's a redesign, so the grille looks a lot better. There's new headlights and a new tub design with new stamping on the tailgate. That tailgate is counterbalanced now, so it's lighter to lift. There's a long overdue new steering wheel. Anyone who's driven the old Navara would know that you used to honk the horn every time you turn the bloody wheel more than 45 degrees in the old car, except for Albor's, of course, because he's never driven one. New slick LCD trip computer, some strengthening done to the rear axle, bigger rear drum brakes, and most utes do still have drum brakes, unfortunately. Payloads up. Every dual cab has a payload more than a ton now. A ton more accessories available, new bars and snorkels and roof platforms to choose from. And the headline news is the addition of standard autonomous emergency braking across the range with blind spot monitoring and lane assist on higher spec grades as well, alongside a 360 camera. So all those tweaks and changes have really addressed most of the areas where that car was particularly flawed before. And, you know, the company's done four updates to this D23 Navara over its six-year life cycle so far. Dual-rate rear springs have really helped its ability to carry loads. It's obviously one of the only utes that's coil-sprung at the rear, in the form of its pickup models anyway, but it actually doesn't mind handling loads now. I was lugging 400 to 500 kilos yesterday without too many dramas. No changes under the bonnet. The 2.3-litre twin-turbo diesel with 140 kilowatts and 450 newton metres remains. Those figures are the same as the D-Max and BT50s, a little bit below the Ranger and Hilux. It's not the quickest thing in the world, but I did get it under 10 seconds to 100. The 7-speed auto is pretty, you know, unobtrusive. It's actually a pretty good thing to drive these days. The steering is a lot less weighty and a lot more wieldy than it used to be. It's still hydraulic, but it's far easier to drive around than the old one was. The ride quality is quite refined. It's super quiet. There's acoustic glass and more sound deadening now. So I recorded at 68 decibels over my test road, which is a few decibels quieter than the Ranger that I took over the same roads recently. There's also drive-away pricing deals on the model. Nissan clearly knows it needs to be somewhat aggressive. Paulie, I know you were filming this car during the week. What are your thoughts, mate? Does this update do enough, in your opinion, to make the Navara, you know, sort of back on people's shopping lists again, or do you reckon it's a bit short of the mark?
No, look, I think if they released this 5 years ago, absolutely, but I think the game has really moved on. While I love the stuff like the headlights, I think they look really cool. I mean, the new steering wheel, seriously, we should have had that three years ago. Like, it was a no-brainer. I think that this car is now, with drive-away pricing, really just going to be a value proposition. But then as a value proposition, it's not that good compared to something like a Triton, which offers a 10-year warranty and better value. So I really don't see what the market is for the Navara. And yes, while the ride is good with the coil springs, I just think that there's far better buying out there. And next year or the year after, we're going to see a brand new Ford Ranger and a Volkswagen Amarok that are really going to make this feel even more dated. So look, I hope Nissan has some tricks up its sleeve, but at this stage, I just can't see how the Navara is going to work in its current state.
I think that Pro 4X helps. I think that looks really tough. It gives them a sort of halo model. I think what else will help is I spoke to the boss of Nissan Australia, Stephen Lester, about this. They're working with Premcar, the Melbourne engineering company that used to do stuff for FPV, once again to do a second iteration of the Warrior, which will be based on that Pro 4X. Now, the Entrek Warrior was a smash hit. They sold 1,400. They only made 1,400, but considering it's a Skunkworks project done in Australia, that's a pretty good effort, I would have thought. The problem Nissan has now is that it's getting global attention. So Nissan's, you know, bigwigs in Japan are now looking very closely at what Nissan Australia is doing with Premcar on this next iteration of the Warrior, which means more resources, but it also means more pressure. So it kind of cuts both ways. But that car will have off-road suspension and mud-plugging tyres and all sorts of, you know, sexy add-ons to kind of make it compete better with the Ranger Raptor and, I don't know, the Gladiator and some of those more lifestyle-focused dudes. I think that will give them the halo they need. But, yeah, Paulie, you're right. It does kind of get a little bit lost. While it's pleasant enough, there are competitors that probably get more column inches. And I don't know, it's going to be hard to see how Nissan really grows its sales in that end of the market.
Okay, you can search Nissan Navara up at carexpert.com. Been a good chat, Mike Costello. Thank you.
Thanks as always, guys.
Hello to you, James Wong.
Hello, everyone. How are you all?
Doing fabulous.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
So much better now that you're here.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. That's good to know.
Quite some time ago, we just briefly chatted about a comparison that you were doing then between the Volkswagen Golf GTI and the Golf GTI TCR. And mm-hmm. the GTI was your car, the one that you own.
Yes.
That comparison now is up at carexpert.com. So we thought we might get you back and go into a little bit more detail about this comparison. It would have been fun to do this with your own car. Did it feel a bit weird?
Yeah, it did. And first of all, apologies to everybody who's been waiting for me to publish this, and it took me a really long time. I'm very busy, and so I just didn't have time to write it. So I've finally gotten around to doing it, and yeah, it was a really fun, and I think more so it was just a really interesting thing to do. So obviously I bought this car a little over a year ago. I wasn't working as a journo at the time, and one of the things I think I've always said, whether it's on record on the podcast or just, you know, in the office, I've always loved the Golf GTI. So when I got the opportunity to buy my own, I just thought it was a no-brainer, and there was nothing else that I was really looking at that sort of ticked all the boxes for the right price. And so I've loved driving it, but now that I'm back as a journo again, in and out of press cars, it's been a bit hard to drive it. So this is one of the first times in a while that I really got behind the wheel and, you know, really assessed it. So it was a little bit weird to have my own car in it, but I really enjoyed sort of picking apart the differences between the two cars, because even though they're based on the same platform, they're virtually, you know, the same body, same interior with different trimmings here and there, they're actually quite different in character. And so I know that for myself, I personally thought about upgrading to either a GTI TCR or a Golf R Final Edition when they were released last year. And I know that there are a few people that I've spoken to in some golf owner groups that have gone through the same thing, because they might have a Mark 7 or Mark 7.5 and they're not sure whether they should upgrade or not. So it was a fun way to sort of not only do my own consumer research, but also help other people who might be going through the same thing.
So why did you decide to keep your GTI, not upgrade?
Well, first of all, cost is one thing. The TCR as a new car is quite expensive, and by the time that I even considered doing it, there was going to be like a 20 grand changeover, which I just didn't see the point of doing, because that's a lot of money for a car that's not that much faster. And, you know, once you read my comparison, I sort of go into detail about how it's a little bit firmer, it's a little bit sharper. So in some ways it's better, but then those benefits also sort of translate to compromises in everyday driving. And so, yes, I'm not driving that car as much, and so I could probably deal with having a car that's a little bit more focused. But it was interesting. And so they both have great attributes, and so they both have drawbacks. I just felt that the balance with my car suited me more, and I think that was something really important that I tried to drive home, is that there are a lot of people that want that hardcore focused, you know, almost track car style drive in their everyday life. I'm not one of those people. I prefer to have that all-round practicality, comfort, refinement, and everything that the standard car has, and I'm not really frequenting the racetrack with it. So for me, it wasn't worth spending that extra money to have that car. But I know that some people will like that. So I think what's important is to perhaps if you don't want to wait for the Mark 8, because I know that the design has polarized some, it's also a lot more expensive now. It's like $53,000 plus on roads for that new one. And it's basically got the same engine and platform as the car. Yeah, the same engine and platform as my car. And I think the claim 0 to 100 is actually slower. So despite all the new features of the new design and everything, some people have been turned off by the new car from what I've seen and heard amongst owners, car fans and whatever, because I've sort of become part of a network of young car owners in Melbourne and Australia, which has been really cool to meet new people, but I digress. So I know what's really important is that if you go to a dealer and you manage to have the two cars side by side, I think the best thing for anybody to do is to try both of them and really figure out whether you can bear the harsher ride and the extra noise of the TCR in day-to-day driving, or depending on how you plan to use it. Because I think for some people like myself, it might be a deal breaker.
What are the performance figures differences between the two?
So the TCR is almost half a second quicker to 100 by the manufacturer's claim. So in terms of powertrain differences, they've basically got the same engine, but the TCR gets a more powerful tune that's much closer to the R. So it's got 213 kilowatts.
Can I just point out here, Wongi, that the TCR actually beat the R around a track with when we had ACCO driving. So
exactly right.
That was pretty, we didn't expect that. We certainly felt like the R should be quicker. Well, I did anyway, and certainly wasn't the case.
Yeah, so the TCR is a really bloody quick thing. People might think that because a lot of people just look at 0 to 100 times and will just palm something off as slow if it isn't under 4-5 seconds or whatever, which is just stupid, because a lot of these front-wheel drive cars, it takes them a while to get traction off the line, which is you lose about half a second to a second anyway. So it's about half a second quicker by the manufacturer's claim. So the Australian model claims 5.8 seconds. We don't get the European tune because we don't get the petrol particulate filter and all that kind of stuff. So in Europe, it gets more torque in a 7-speed DSG, whereas our model gets a 350 newton meter tune and a 6-speed DSG. So it's more probably it's got less ratios to choose from, so it accelerates a little bit harder. And I think that they don't do it here, but they also can do a top speed delimiter in Europe. But yeah, as Albor's said, it's actually quicker around a track than an R, because it's got the same power output, but it's about 100 kilos lighter. And there's all sorts of things that they've upgraded to make it more performance focused, in the sense that it's got better brakes, it's got a lower ride height, it's got bigger wheels and stickier tires. There's little changes here and there to make it a little bit more track biased, if so to say. But yeah, as Albor said, it's actually really, really quick around the track. And I've watched plenty of videos from Europe and the UK where people do like 0 to 100 and 0 to 200 tests in all the different Golf models. And there was one guy who took all three models on the Autobahn, and the TCR actually out accelerated the R from 100 to 200. By quite some margin. Yeah, so it's really, really fast, and like in-gear acceleration in this thing is noticeably different compared to mine. It's got a lot more muscle behind it, and I think also because it's got one less gear to cycle through, it's much more assertive in how it just kicks down and it just goes. And once you're going, you know, once you're rolling, you don't get like the axle tramp and the tire spin that you'd get off the line. So it's just, it feels a lot faster, even if the time on paper doesn't look like that much faster, if that makes sense. So, yeah.
What are the interior differences? Does the TCR have the tartan or not the tartan?
It's got a funny interpretation of tartan. So I, as an enthusiast and a bit of a purist, I made sure that I didn't option leather and all that other nonsense on my car. But I know a lot of people in Australia like a sunroof and leather. So, you know, shout out to those people who don't have taste. But anyway, the new one, the TCR has the TCR has an interesting take on it. So it's got a different seat trim and there's a few different like touches here and there. So the seats have a like a tartan or a plaid pattern, but it's got like a tire streak through it and there's suede everywhere and looks a little bit different. You've got red pinstripes on the seat belts. You've got a perforated leather steering wheel with a red 12 o'clock marker. And I think the gear shift boot has suede trim as well. So those are the main differences. But really, other than that, it was pretty much specified identically to my car in having the digital cockpit with the smaller 8-inch screen with navigation. So it's really just trim differences inside. There's not really any difference. But it does feel a little bit racier. And having – I really like Alcantara and suede finishes, so I like that. Mm-hmm. I wish it was on the steering wheel actually because I think that's really cool and racy, but I know some people don't like getting oily hands on it. But other than that, it's still a Golf. So, you know, passenger space is the same. Boot space is the same. The infotainment system's the same. The only real thing that I found was that there's a, you know how there's like that silver trim at the bottom of the steering wheel with the GTI badge? In my one, it's got like a polished finish that makes it shiny and glossy and it feels almost like metal. Whereas in the TCR, it was almost a matte finish and it felt really yucky and plasticky. So I don't know whether that was just a running change in the factory that they decided to change the plastic on it. But I noticed that stepping in and out of two of them and I was like, oh, that's a bit cheap. But
yeah. Attention to detail is incredible.
Yes, I know.
Your attention to detail. So obviously putting aside that you owned one of these cars, which one did you give the win to?
As I said before, it really depends on who is buying or who is looking between the two cars. For me personally, I still prefer my car because I intend to use it as a daily driver. And for me, the concept of a Golf GTI is to be an all-round, you know, practical daily driving performance car. And for me, the normal one does that job better. It's not the differences are minuscule enough that I don't feel like you're missing out on too much performance or too much this or too much that. But the benefits of getting the lesser model with more comfort, you know, in terms of comfort, refinement, and all those sort of things, I think makes a bigger difference in day-to-day driving than what you'll find the TCR does on the track. I don't know, because most people aren't going to do that. And unfortunately in Australia, we don't have autobahns where you can be like, okay, I'm going to go from 100 to 250 now and it's going to make a huge difference because I got the more powerful car. So for me personally, that works for me. I know that, as I said earlier, there are some people that would perhaps come out of a Civic Type R or a Megane RS or a Focus ST that, you know, those cars are very, very track focused. They're very firm. They've got performance tires on them that can be quite loud on the freeway. And the Golf probably adds a layer of refinement compared to those cars that might make it seem more livable. But yeah, between the two, I have to keep it within the context of those two cars that I tested. And for me, the standard GTI is a better fit for me.
Fair enough. You can read that very in-depth comparison up at carexpert.com. Great read, JWO. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The 2021 Hyundai Tucson is all new and is completely unrecognizable. Paul, you had a chance to drive the Highlander variant with the now N-Line package. How important is this all-new Tucson for Hyundai?
Extremely, Mandy. It's one of their best-selling models. And the new Tucson, it was launched recently in both a short wheelbase and a long wheelbase version. We'll be getting the long wheelbase. That means that it is slightly longer than a RAV4 and sits on a longer wheelbase as well. And all of that means that inside the cabin, there's actually a lot of room. We shot a video of this, and if you head to carexpert.com.au, you can see it, a video of the N-Line. You can see how much leg room I have in the rear. It's actually quite accommodating for adults, so you can imagine what it's going to be like for kids. At the front of the cabin, they've also got a whole bunch of new technology, so an LCD screen ahead of the driver and also a new infotainment system as well that they've taken from Kia. So it's a really good unit, high resolution display. It's actually a HD display. Unfortunately, it doesn't pick up the HD cameras for the reverse view and 360 camera that the Kias do. So hopefully the car that we drove was pre-production. Hopefully the final version will have that. But the design has split people's opinions. It is very interesting. I was going to ask you about that.
Are you sold on it?
Well, look, I thought it was a bit yuck in pictures, but in person it actually looks really impressive. What do you guys think of the design? Do you think it is impressive or not?
Yeah, I also saw it in person and thought that it looked pretty good, although I kept looking at it and I went, it looks really good now. I wonder how it will look in 2-3 years' time.
That's a good
point. That's what I was thinking.
Because it's really quite out there and very modern and very angular. It reminds me of the i45. Do you guys remember that?
Yes, that's right.
And that was a very edgy design. And although they seem to have completely disappeared from the road, I have not seen an i45 forever. I look at it now with that weird snail-like design, headlights and stuff, and it looks quite odd. So I wonder if this is going to be going down the same way. My biggest concern with it is just the wheels. The wheels are really weird. They look odd.
Now, this is interesting. I really like the wheels, but a lot of people...
you have awful taste. Awful, awful taste.
Unless it's in relation to cars. A lot of people said they didn't like them. And one person pointed out something really interesting. They would be impossible to clean. And I completely agree with that. They would be very hard to clean. Look, it's an interesting car because the end line to me is Hyundai's ability to add a bit of spice to the range. Now, they're introducing end line across the entire Tucson range, which means that you can option it on the base model. And that's a good thing because you can have the base model, but then you get all the extra features to the end line, which is the LCD display, the wheels and all that sort of stuff. The only problem I've got is that the car that we drove was a 1.6-litre turbo petrol. It just lacked a little bit of punch. It felt a little bit slow and I don't know. I think that engine just needs a little bit more in it. Thankfully, though, you can get a 2-litre diesel that has like over 400 newton metres of torque, and I think that's going to be the sweet spot because that 1.6 is a 265 newton metre sort of offering with all-wheel drive and a dual-clutch transmission. I just don't think it's going to be enough. So let's hope they address that before it launches locally. But my pick's probably going to be the diesel, and I'd be ticking the N-line box just because I think it looks really nice and schmick.
Mm.
Really? Why the diesel? Why would you buy the diesel?
Just because of the torque. The other alternative is the 2-litre naturally aspirated one, which is just not a great engine, but sits there at the entry level. And the 1.6, I just felt it was just a little underdone. And that was just with me and Igor, video guy in the car. And Igor is the size of, you know, two bits of rice put together. So, you know, it was barely...
Does this mean that they're going to put the 2-litre turbo in the Tucson N and do it properly?
Well, they claim there's no Tucson N coming. And you think about it and it's like, well, why? You've got all this other N stuff. Don't make an N line that you don't make any more powerful. So, look, I really hope they either put the 2-litre or a 2.5-litre. So, the 2.5-litre would be a really cracking engine. So, look, let's see what they do. But I just wish it had a little bit more punch out of the 1.6.
How did it ride on Aussie roads?
Good question, Mandy. We drove it at a racetrack that was recently resurfaced. So, I have no idea. So, the reason they did that is it's a pre-production car and they only have a number of engineers that are allowed to drive it on public roads. That's part of the conditions of registration for a car that will eventually be crushed or taken back overseas. So, we were only allowed to drive it on a private road, which was this racetrack that literally was probably resurfaced 2 months ago because it was smoothest thing I've ever driven on. So, I don't know, but I suspect it'll be good. They're doing a local ride and handling program on it. It doesn't get adaptive damping like the European versions of the N-Line. So, I'll be keen to see whether that affects it at all. But knowing Hyundai, I suspect it'll be pretty well sorted.
All right, you can check out the video and the written review up at carexpert.com.au. That is a wrap. Paul, we've got a bit of sad news coming from you this week.
Yes. I've had a whole bunch of people reach out to me. I tried to do this as discreetly as I could, but it didn't really work. I listed my Supra for sale, and it's because we live in Victoria, where for most of last year I wasn't allowed to drive a car further than the shops, and my poor Supra was sitting there gathering dust, and I thought, look, I have a little one on the way. I've been reminded by my wife that it needs to go. So, I listed it for
it's
sale.
It's a perfect family car though, Paul.
Yes, exactly. Listed it for sale. Literally the day that I listed it for sale, someone contacted me wanting to come and have a look at the car. So, I organized to meet with them. They're a fan of Car Expert.
Say that one more time. I just want to hear it.
For those that missed it, I accidentally said the wrong place. They're probably a fan of the other place as well for the moment. So, look, they have bought the car, and I'm absolutely thrilled that it's actually going to someone that's going to enjoy it as much as I have. I cared meticulously for the car and kept it in pretty much excellent condition. It lived in my sort of underground parking here, so it was always sort of looked after. So, look, I mean, I'm just glad that someone is going to enjoy it, and it's a sad day for me because I have to let it go, but a happy day for me also because it means that someone will be able to get around in it. So, if you see my car about the place, it's not me driving it. It is the new owner, and, give them a wave.
Have you kept the personalised plates, or did you sell them with the car?
No, they're going with the car as well.
Cool.
I really don't have much use from. I was going to pop them on the Tesla, but I thought, oh, people won't understand it. I guess so, give them to Elbors.
Yeah.
Yes. You've just put them on your new car.
Yeah, mine's not a jet BMW, though.
No, yours is just rubbish.
Mine is an appreciating asset, unlike your...
No, it's definitely not. I promise you that.
Yes, I accidentally bought a car on Valentine's Day.
Accidentally?
Well, it's kind of like how Paul keeps buying HSVs. It was an auction online, and this guy kept outbidding me, and out of spite, I kept outbidding him. And then finally, he stopped outbidding me, and I accidentally won a car. And I was like, oh, that was not expected. But no, I bought a Mitsubishi 3000 GT or a GTO, whatever you want to call it. I love that car. I've always wanted one. So it just happens to be that I bought one when I didn't really want one at the exact time. But it's arrived in Brisbane. It's currently having a lot of money spent on it at a mechanic. It's going to get a full body respray. I got the insurance quote for it today, and I'm just looking at all these costs adding up and saying, why did I do this again? But you know what? It drives really nicely, and it's nice to own something that's just old school and old fashioned and makes the Fast and Furious sounds. And I don't know, it makes me happy.
You know what, Mandy, for those who are listening that don't know what that car is, it's basically the cheaper, slower, worse version of the Honda NSX. So that's basically the best way to describe it.
That's probably quite an accurate way to describe it. But for me, it's the NSX, the Mitsubishi 3000 GT, the Subaru SVX, all those random old Japanese wannabe supercars that never quite made it. Awesome. Like I reckon they're so cool. And the GTO for me was the worst of the lot because Mitsubishi, it was such a massive failure for Mitsubishi. Like it was just so unpopular and no one wanted it. It was heavy. It had rear wheel steering, it had active aerodynamics, everything that just nobody wanted.
Everything that is going to fail at some point.
and they removed them all because none of it worked towards the end. So look, I love it. It doesn't really fit in my garage of other cars, but it doesn't matter. I still think it's a really cool thing, and I'm glad I bought it.
Well, can I just say as well that I do hang shit on Elbors for the car, but I think that now people are starting to realize that before long, you heard it in the news earlier that, you know, all of these car companies are going full electric by, you know, some point. We all have these cars that we grew up with and we now can afford to own. Now's the time to buy these and line your garage with them. For me, it's old Holdens and HSVs, and for Elbors, it's this Japanese thing. But I think that now is the time to be getting the car you've always wanted to have, because I reckon before long, we're going to have nanny state laws come in that stop us from being allowed to drive loud, fast cars that, you know, aren't electric. So, yeah.
Elbors fella and Paul Merrick, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Mandy.